Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, what's on the plate for Michigan's lame duck legislature?
The governor wants to get some of these things done because while he'll still have Republican majorities in both houses next year, the majority in the House is going to be substantially less.
Plus, building bridges, not walls, parenting a gay child.
Coming out is a moment of risk and opportunity for parents and children.
Welfare reforms in Michigan, at what price?
The whole concept of this was that by removing these FISCACHA assistants, people were going to get into the workforce, and we have not found evidence that that is happening.
And the Big Ten's rolling out the welcome mat for Maryland and Rutgers? Those stories and much, much more on today's show. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, Understanding Your Child's Sexual Orientation, we'll talk with the author of the new book, Coming Around, Parenting Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Kids. And we'll check in with Michigan Watch's Lester Graham about cuts to state cash assistant benefits to families all around Michigan. But first, lame duck. No, we're not talking about some odd, fancy Thanksgiving dish. Lame duck is a term for when one legislature meets after an election, but before a new legislature is sworn in. We're in the middle of one right now in Michigan. The crop of new and returning lawmakers will make their way to the Capitol to be sworn in come January. But till then, there is work to be done. Joining us now is Jack Lessenberry, political analyst for Michigan Radio, and Dave Eggert, who is the political reporter for MLive. Thanks to both of you for being here. First, let's start with a quick primer. Dave, how do these lame duck sessions differ from normal sessions?
The main difference is there's more of a built-in deadline for legislators. I mean, if they don't get bills passed and finalized and sent to the governor's desk by the end of the year, they essentially have to start over again. So that's where some of the pressure comes in to get something done on things that have maybe languished out there for a while.
And Jack, from your perspective and watching legislatures over the years, do things tend to get done with greater dispatch than they do during regular sessions?
Well, sometimes. There's an advantage in that. Of course, as Dave said, there's time pressure. But some of these folks, because of term limits, won't be coming back. Some of them have been elected for the last time and can't run again, so they have some pressure off. And others may feel that people aren't looking as closely now as they would be in January or in the run-up to the election. So I think they feel somewhat more liberated and also under somewhat more pressure to get things done.
Well, we saw a quote from Senate Majority Leader Randy Richardville, who said, it's going to have to be a well-orchestrated event once lame duck gets here. So now that this well-orchestrated event's underway, what are we seeing right now in lame duck?
So far, some of the top few things that seem to be at the top of the list are reforming Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan. There's a proposal that would essentially end its tax-exempt status and turn it into a charitable trust, or from a charitable trust to a customer-owned nonprofit. And that's an issue that will be heavily lobbied about in the next few weeks. There's been hearings going on for a number of months, and that's one that's definitely at the top of the list. Another one, the governor has wanted to reduce personal property taxes that businesses pay. This is a pretty big issue for manufacturers in the state who did not necessarily benefit as much as other businesses did from his business tax reform in 2011. So that's another one that's pressing for lawmakers. But local governments are concerned that they would take a big hit to their revenue, things that fund police and fire, other local services.
In fact, I just saw that survey that was done by the Ford School that a huge percentage, 67% of local leaders say they don't trust the state to follow through on full replacement revenue absent some kind of guarantee from the Constitution. So there doesn't seem to be a lot of trust on behalf of the local leaders toward the legislators. Does that surprise you, Jack?
Oh, not at all, given the revenue cuts they've had in recent years and other record of betrayed promises. The legislators would say, well, it couldn't be helped because of the recession. What I'm looking at most heavily here is whether they're going to attempt to come up with a replacement for the emergency manager law. Now, that was the, you know, Public Act 4 that was on the ballot. We had a referendum on it at the election. It lost. It was a lot closer than the constitutional amendments, but it lost nevertheless, and there's a strong feeling on the part of the governor and some other folks that some kind of replacement is needed. The tricky thing is they have to come up with something that doesn't appear to be flaunting the will of the voters, but is strong enough to give them the ability to deal with the 8-million-pound elephant in the room, which, of course, is the city of Detroit. There's a great anticipation that at some point the state is going to become more actively involved, have to become more involved in running Detroit, and they need a better mechanism for doing that.
Jack, from your perspective, that is a delicate balancing act. What do you think the new law, what form should it take?
Well, that's really not for me to say. I think it certainly needs to give whoever the emergency manager is the tools to effectively do what needs to be done. There was a lot of criticism because this law gave them the power to void union contracts. The current emergency financial manager law that it's reverted back to, this is a law stemming from the 1980s, gives the emergency financial managers a lot of power, but not that power. So the governor could argue that this only lost because everybody was saying vote no on all these amendments, but whether politically he can do that or not is a dicey question. So the trick is, can they do it in lame duck? Now, it also should be said that the governor wants to get some of these things done because while he'll still have Republican majorities in both houses next year, the majority in the House is going to be substantially less. So on some issues, if a few Republicans break off and side with the Democrats in the House, the governor will lose. So it's better to get this stuff done now.
I think Jack's right that, you know, the governor, you know, part of the concern about the law was that it overreached and took too much power away, and you know, the issue of voiding union contracts. The last I heard the governor say is he wanted to take some of the parts of the law that he felt were not as controversial and put those in there. Some of those are things like, you know, he likes the newer law, the one that was repealed, because it had, like, he felt had more early warning mechanisms that could tip the state off further in advance that some of these local governments and school districts were on the cusp of financial problems. So I think you'll see some of those, that sort of mechanism language, maybe added into whatever sort of bill they come up with.
Jack, you touched on this a little bit in your previous answer, but can we go a little bit deeper with both of you? How do you think the election helped shape this year's lame duck session? Just what dynamics from November 6th are going to impact that? Dave, what's your thoughts?
One thing that it will shape a bit, the direct impact of the election, is there's been a debate in Michigan about the Affordable Care Act and the health care exchanges. And I think you've already seen some movement from House Speaker Jace Bulger and other Republicans that now, yes, they are interested in implementing a state-based exchange. There had been a lot of resistance to that ahead of the election. I think people partly wanted to see what would happen if the president would be reelected or if the Republicans could take the U.S. Senate. Now that that law is definitely here to stay, I think you're seeing more Republicans that are willing in lame duck to work on a bill that would help the governor run a state-based exchange instead of having the federal government do it.
There seems to be a bit of a rivalry between the governor and Attorney General Bill Schuette. The governor wanted these exchanges set up before the election. Bill Schuette told the legislators, don't do that because we know Romney's going to be elected and he'll get rid of Obamacare. Well, that didn't happen, and so Michigan's a little bit scrambling behind to try to come up with one of these exchanges by the time of the deadline. I think the deadline will be extended, but still they're having to do it on a catch-as-catch-can basis. I think the election, by and large, it was a good thing for the governor, and it gives him some leverage in lame duck, precisely because the majority, he will still have a majority, but it's going to be reduced, and it helps him make the case you need to do the stuff now. But not everything will get done. They're talking about doing an impossible list of things. I've seen about 12 things they've talked about doing in lame duck. By Christmas time, we should have a good idea before Christmas how successful the governor was.
Jack, Dave, thanks so much for being on the show.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Dave Eggert covers politics for MLive, and Jack Lessenberry is the political analyst for Michigan Radio. Well, it looks as though the Big Ten's rolling out the welcome mat for two new members. The news today is that Maryland and Rutgers, yes, you heard that right, Maryland and Rutgers could be about to join the Big Ten, turning the Big Ten into a 14-team super conference.
Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon joins us now. John, how's this news sitting with Big Ten fans?
I can tell you on the Michigan chat boards for the football fans there on MGO blog, rivals.com, and others, the Wolverine, it is 98% apocalyptic disgust.
Wow.
Oh, yes. It should be noted, by the way, is in great contrast to Penn State joining in 93 and Nebraska joining last year. They're not against expansion per se, but Nebraska and Penn State fit the model, fit the footprint, all that stuff, very much part of the same traditions. Here's one little phrase for you. I am going to throw up. If you don't laugh, you'll cry, etc. It has not gone over well.
Is it because of the geography more than anything? I mean, Nebraska fits with us, so does Pennsylvania, but the state of Pennsylvania, but I don't know, Rutgers and Maryland, isn't it just geographically wrong to be talking about both these schools?
Well, Big Ten is not an East Coast league, obviously, and Penn State is as far as you go, and even that was controversial at the time.
Yeah.
These are two urban centers. The whole reason why they're doing this, of course, is the Big Ten network footprint. We can add subscribers, and this can add up to around $200 million payday right away. That'll be per year also. So it's pretty amazing as to what you can get for this one move, and that's why they're doing it. I can think of no other reason why they would do it. And that also has got the fans apoplectic about what is happening now. So it's about the TV dollars and about little else that I can figure.
Could I just, I don't know, throw it out there? Could we make any case for, oh, gee, there's some new rivalries, new teams to watch?
Cindy, you're sweet. No, Rutgers, I grant them this. They played in the first ever football game on November 6th, 1869, against Princeton, then the College of New Jersey. They won 6-4. I guess they're the number one team in the nation that week, and they've never been back since. So Maryland and Rutgers get about 30,000 to 40,000 fans per football game, which brings down the average tremendously in the Big Ten. Nebraska sells it out. Penn State usually sells it out.
Yeah.
So this is definitely a step down as far as that goes.
This is going to happen. I'm sure this isn't a, hey, we're sending up a trial balloon, but this is, as they say, done and dusted, eh?
ESPN is reporting that Maryland is in as of today and Rutgers will be in as of tomorrow. So I think it's looking quite solid. I will say this, though. I heard it first on the radio coming back from the Michigan State-Northwestern game up in East Lansing. I couldn't believe it. I assume this is just, you know, more blog silliness. And no, it is dead on.
So that sound we're hearing is the howling of Big Ten fans all over, all 12 schools worth of them howling away as it appears Maryland and Rutgers will be joining the Big Ten. John U. Bacon, thanks for joining us today.
Cindy, thank you.
Still ahead, thousands of families in Michigan have been cut from cash assistance benefits since new reforms took place. We'll check in with two reporters who've been following those families. That's in 20 minutes on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. How does a parent react when a child says the words, "I'm gay"? Well, the answer can make all the difference in the world between having a child who can find his or her way in the world knowing that mom and dad are there supporting and trying to understand, and having a child who carries what can be a crippling burden, trying to come to terms with being gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender and feeling isolated and alone. Anne Dorenwend has taken her life's experiences as a gay person, a psychologist, and a parent, and she's poured all of that into her new book, Coming Around, Parenting Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Kids. It's out from New Horizon Press, and Dr. Dorenwend joins us here in the studio, along with Mike Newbecker, who's with the support group PFLAG. They're the Detroit Downriver chapter of Parents, Families, and Friends of Lesbians and Gays. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you here with us. And I want to start with you. Overall, is coming out something that is more easily accepted in 2012 than, let's say, a generation ago?
Without a doubt it is. But there are two sort of pieces to this. Kids are coming out earlier, and as a result, the younger people come out, the more prone they are to having suicidal ideation and committing suicide. And that's probably because they don't have the coping mechanisms to deal with oppression and discrimination and negative reactions. But the good side of coming out early is that they're incorporating their sexual identity more completely, and therefore they don't hit a barrier with social-emotional development. which, in other words, sexual identity development should happen when you're about 15 to 17, right?
Right.
And so, so that you can go on and learn how to have healthy, intimate relationship, you know, even go on and be successful in career, grounding, a grounded sense of self. So there are pluses and minuses. Kids are coming out earlier. There are clearly more opportunities to connect with groups like PFLAG. There's much more support. You go into, but it depends on where you live.
It depends on
your family. It depends on what your school is, where your school is,
yeah.
What state you live in.
Because there's a difference, huge differences, right? There's a whole spectrum of reaction to that announcement.
Yeah, there's an unfair situation for gays right now. Some states, some communities are very accepting. Others are still very rejecting.
And PFLAG is a very important resource for families and for parents who hear those words. And Mike Neubecker, can you tell us your family story?
Well, I'm a field engineer by trade. And one day I was looking for a pair of socks that matched, and I couldn't find a pair anywhere in the house. But we had the spare sock drawer. So I went into the other room where the spare sock drawer was, and I found that I was looking for a same socks couple. And, in fact, once inside that drawer, what did I find in there but a PFLAG pamphlet? And when I first looked at it, PFLAG, what is that? And then I read a little bit and had the word gay in there and homosexual. I thought, what is this? Is my son gay or something? I asked my wife about it, and she had actually been keeping it to herself for about a month and a half, because when my son mm-hmm. came out, she said, oh, this isn't a good time. You know, your dad's not going to go well with this. We got to get you paid for school. He was going to EMU. Mm-hmm. And she was afraid of my reaction. So finally, I had to make that call, left it on his machine that this is your dad, and I really need to talk to you right away. This is important. So he knew right then that I got the news finally. And he was in an ROTC program. So for him, it was risky because he had to actually leave the program.
Did he?
And give up a scholarship. Oh. So right away it was an issue of, first of all, I thought he was mistaken, confused, and I went through, I found a lot of bad information, inaccurate information mm-hmm. from a lot of sources that were more Christian-based that were saying how you can change your orientation through prayer and so forth. And I did a little bit of looking into that, but actually the resources I found there were harmful,
okay,
very harmful. And so now, I mean, I did transition to acceptance, but only after a little independent study, and I evolved on it very quickly.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Do you accept that your wife and son both thought Dad isn't going to like this very much? Was that kind, or did that surprise you when you were made aware?
No,
of
No, I think they were pretty on the mark. They knew I was going to go off the deep end and wonder what happened and what influences made my son gay, because I was sure he was straight when he went off to college, when in fact he'd been struggling alone. And I became very selfish, like, well, what are my friends at Kiwanis going to say? What are my golf buddies going to say? Especially remembering them telling gay jokes and I'm laughing at them. Mm-hmm. So suddenly I felt like a big old hypocrite, and I've always been very proud of my son. But here is like, I don't know, can I still be proud of my son? So for me it was like, I've got to figure this out.
Wow. And this must be something that is repeated in countless times in families.
Your story is, and I know you know this, but your story is common. And when kids come out, they tend to come out to their fathers last. There's been a recent study that found there wasn't that gender difference in which parent they came out to. But all studies before that, fathers tend to be they're the last to know. And probably that's connected to the gender rigidity that our culture sets men up to, you know, have to be sort of super macho, and that leads to more internalized homophobia. And it's a terrible shame because, it's one of those factors that can cause a kid to bury their sexual identity. I think it's amazing that you were so active in seeking help that you ended up playing a major role with PFLAG. I mean, I'm always amazed by people who do that for their children. When I wrote this book, my goal was to try to reach people who were more conservative. I think a lot of literature out there has a very liberal bent to it, a liberal language, and maybe even a little damning of conservative, you know, dogma. And I don't know if I succeeded. I hope I did. But I try to really help parents who thought that they couldn't accept a homosexual child to slowly evolve to acceptance. So, for instance, I don't know if you would agree with this, but my first advice would be to step back and simply say to your child, I love you, and to say, I'm proud of you, and I'm glad you told me, because I think that conveys I'm not going to disappear, I'm not going to crumble. And if you have a difference of opinion or think homosexuality is a sin, to step back and just recognize that moment is not a time to deal with that issue. That you have to, whether you're liberal or conservative, everybody has internalized homophobia. And a parent has to step back and take the time to reassess what their understanding of homosexuality. So
that is good advice, because the very first advice I got from a minister was, you need to be able to reach out to your son early on and tell him that, you know, I may never be comfortable with this or accept it, but you're my son and I love you.
Oh, that was wise advice.
And I was able to say that, but now I can remove all that uncomfortable part because, you know, his life right now is as normal as I've ever expected it. Him and his partner, they have adopted two children. We've been grandparents for 5 years
Congratulations.
Now. Congratulations. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they're delightful children.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Anne Dorenwin. She's a psychologist, a parent, and the author of the new book, Coming Around, Parenting Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Kids. And Mike Neubecker, he's with the support group PFLAG, Parents, Families, and Friends of Lesbians and Gays. So, Mike, at the time your son came out, you said you turned to a minister and you got sensitive, wise advice. And I'm sure you hear this a lot, Anne. There are parents whose religious beliefs truly do not embrace homosexuality. So you have these ingrained beliefs you've carried for years, but you want to support and you want to love your gay child. And that must set up all kinds of churning emotions.
You know, there's another issue here, too. There's so many things I'd like to react to.
Sure.
Only so much time. But I think a lot of gay kids end up not only being divorced from their families, ostracized, but also made to feel like the other in their churches and end up being angry and bitter about religion. And there's no reason for that. That's one problem. I think kids need to stay connected to their parents. A lot of the health disparities that gay children suffer get diminished as long as they maintain connection with their parents and feel their parents accept them. Those who don't get accepted by their parents are at higher risk for depression, anxiety, drug and alcohol abuse.
Risky behavior.
All kinds of risky behavior.
Suicide.
Smoking. Mm. 2 to 7 times more likely to commit suicide. So, you know, when you think about the fidelity of being a parent to your child, there's really no good reason to disconnect from your child. And there's no good reason for a church to cause a child to feel on the outside. And many churches don't feel that way.
Mm. And in your book, you offer some pretty wise insights about struggling with pain and adversity that can actually enrich a youngster or a young person?
There have been very few studies that look at positive aspects of being gay. Mm-hmm. And there's been some recent studies that have started to do that. And what they see is that, and I can sort of relate to this even when I think about my gay friends who have come through and out, you know, the other side, who are really comfortable with their sexuality. Mm-hmm. There's added courage. There's less concern about what other people think. There can be a sense of really growing dignity, a sense of integrity. People talk about being in the study. They talk about some gay folks saying that they felt that they weren't trapped by gender norms in the same way as their heterosexual peers, especially men, in terms of talking about emotion and having platonic relationships. Right, with other men or with women. That's just the tip of the iceberg. But I also think that there's a great sensitivity, I think, that can be learned about oppression in general and understanding what it's like to be treated as different.
Mike, you commented on one of your first
initial and I think understandable reaction was, my God, how do I tell the Kiwanis? How do I tell people in my social circle? And I wanted both of you to give us some thoughts on the do's and don'ts of breaking that news. You know, Johnny has come out. How do you tell Grandma?
Well, here's how it happened in our case. Yeah. I initially told my son, and I got the same advice from a minister, well, you might want to keep this quiet because of discrimination and hate crimes and so forth. But my son said, no, Dad, it's too important to be a role model for others. I'm not going to live my life hiding who I am. And immediately, I kind of went and I wanted to go in the closet as a parent. I said, well, I don't want anybody else to know. He said, well, I'm not going to be closeted. I said, well, can you at least give us a little time? He said, sure, but it won't be forever. Okay. And it was less than a month. He called me up on the phone and said, well, Dad, I hope you're ready for this. I was at the Cracker Barrel restaurant in Belleville, and I was protesting their discrimination against gay people. And I was arrested, and I'm going to be on TV tonight. So I thought, well, son, and at that point, I had enough time to say, okay, well, I'm proud of you, son. You're standing up for your rights. And since then, they've changed their policy.
They have.
But called my mom, and I just dropped in the next morning because I knew she knew by then. And I said, oh, I saw Bridget said Lee was on TV last night at the Cracker Barrel. Why was he there? And I said, well, he's gay, Mom. And, I mean, I could have said he was eating and, you know, hidden.
Yeah, just happened to be there.
Right. But anyway, it was time to come out as a parent, and I really hadn't been to PFLAG yet. That would have helped a lot because I could have talked to other parents, heard stories of kids coming out, been a little more sensitive on the whole issue. But he was not going to stay in the closet. In fact, he broke the hinges off of it, so that door wasn't going back.
So what did Grandma say?
Grandma said, oh, I was wondering, but he doesn't look gay. So, and my dad, I mean, he was pretty conservative.
Okay.
But he was fine. He was like, you know, Lee is a great kid, and you shouldn't be ashamed of him. And, you know, I hope you're not, because I'm not. I said, no, I just want to let you know. And from then on, once my parents knew and they seemed accepting, it was the beginning of a process. But it's amazing how much changed in our whole family because of this. Even when they got married, we had a big reception, and almost all of my family were there.
And that, Anne, I think must make you just feel, okay, this is a really good example of a family that took this challenge. It was a challenge for your son, Lee. It took challenge for you, Mike, as the dad, and you came through, and I can hear you say your life is richer for all of this.
Oh, life is
great.
Yeah,
coming out is a moment of risk and opportunity for parents and children. And you made it the opportunity. It can make for a much closer family. It unlocks a trap door of secrets in families, and people begin to talk about not just sexuality, but other things that maybe they didn't talk about before. It makes families more intimate when they engage with their child. And there are families that withdraw, and whole family will withdraw socially. They'll be closeted families, and that is the opposite effect.
But it usually is a dynamic situation. Initially, there may be rejection. And I think as long as people aren't too closed-minded, they can evolve on it. But a closed mind is a very expensive thing to have. I've seen families break apart because of it.
Yep.
I would have to think that the absolute worst mistake a parent can make when the child comes out is to kick that child out.
It is the worst. Again, they suffer from those higher levels of health disparities. But once a kid is on the street, even a resilient child doesn't do well after about 6 months. And they resort to survival sex and drugs and alcohol. And you know from PFLAG how soul-wrenching it is to be rejected by parents for something like sexual orientation, which is like your arms and your legs. It's who you are.
We've heard. I mean, we keep confidentiality of any person's story in generality, but we've seen it. We've seen the gamut of where they go to visit their parents on Christmas morning and they won't open the door and they've left presents. The presents are mailed back to them. I mean, that's the total rejection. But sometimes these parents, even though they love their kid, they feel like they're doing this tough love thing. In other words, the kids will want
He'll
their
come
love
around.
So much that they'll conform to do whatever they want. And I say to these parents that really love is a verb because I've had parents say, well, I love my kid. I just can't accept this. So they have to respect
my position, and I'll respect theirs, but I can't have them come to my house and talk about their partner and so forth. And I said, well, love's a verb. If you really love your kid, why wouldn't you try to educate yourself at least? Go to the library or go online and
absolutely
try to inform yourself.
Every parent owes it to their kid to reassess homosexuality if they have a gay kid, to step back and look at that. In terms of love, the child's love of the parent, sometimes they'll bend until they break to try to stay connected with that parent. It's cruel to reject a kid.
Thank you for the discussion today. It was really a good conversation, and it's been good to have you here on Stateside.
Thanks for your interest. Thank you, Doc.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Ann Derwin-Wend, who's the author of the new book, Coming Around, Parenting Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Kids, and Mike Neubecker. He's with the support group PFLAG, the Detroit Downriver chapter of parents, families, and friends of lesbians and gays. Here at Stateside, we always want to connect with you and hear from you. You can find us online at michiganradio.org. We're on Facebook. Just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and that's C-A-N-T-Y. And we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Offer up your comments, suggest a story, or someone you think we should profile. Still to come, thousands of families in Michigan have been cut from cash assistance benefits since new reforms took place. We'll check in with two reporters who've been following those families. That's coming up on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Turning now to the subject of welfare benefits, or more specifically, the loss of cash assistance to thousands of families in Michigan. The number of Michigan families getting cash assistance benefits from the state plummeted to the lowest level in more than 40 years, just 9 months after reforms were implemented. 12 months in, the state is spending nearly $18 million a month less on cash assistance, the cumulative result of reform and an improving economy. More than 9,000 Michigan families were cut from cash assistance last fall, a number that grew close to 15,000 as months passed. No other state has removed so many families from welfare in such a short amount of time with so little notice. We wondered about the impact on those thousands of families who lost benefits or ones who are getting cash assistance temporarily pending the outcome of a complex legal battle. Lester Graham with Michigan Watch has been following the story for Michigan Radio, as has Ron French, a writer for Bridge Magazine. Welcome to both of you. Ron, let's start with you. Recap for us just what happened with these welfare benefits.
Last fall, the legislature chose to reform welfare in a way that put time limits on welfare recipients. Now, there had always been time limits, but they started actually enforcing them. And the legislature wanted to enforce a limit of 48 months on welfare recipients, but in an odd sort of circumstance, actually, most of the people then who were kicked off because of federal limits that also began to be enforced. The legislature and the governor wanted to move more people from welfare into the workforce, and they felt the way to do that was to eliminate the cash assistance. And what happened in reality is that the Department of Human Services took it a step further and really kicked off a lot more people than would have been kicked off otherwise.
So suddenly we saw 11,000 people, 11,000 families, I should say, kicked off of cash assistance, which basically meant that they couldn't pay their utilities, they couldn't pay their rent. They still had food aid, and they still had Medicaid, the insurance for the poor, medical insurance for the poor, but they didn't have any way to pay for rent or pay for utilities and things like that.
And how much warning did they get?
Not very much, which was one of the first reasons that the advocates went to court. And they said, look, you need to give these people more time. But this has been a series of court cases over the several months that it's been going on, and it's been quite complicated. Ron's done a fantastic job in Bridge Magazine in keeping up with a lot of these facts. But the more important part is what's happened to these families.
The human toll. And you've both been covering this. Ron, what are you finding has been the impact in terms of numbers of families getting benefits, for starters?
Well, it's been frustrating to report on this because there's so little hard data. The state has not tracked the families who were removed from cash assistance. So we don't have any hard numbers to say among the what is now about 15,000 families who have been removed from cash assistance in the past 12 months, how many of them are employed. How many of them are employed in a way that has replaced the money they would have received from the state? So we end up having to look at other things, such as what is the overall unemployment rate, how many families are on food stamps, things like that, and you really don't know if they're the same families or not. What we know anecdotally, and I think Lester has run into the same situation, is Bridge Magazine tried to follow the same families for the full 12 months to see what happened to them as they adjusted. The assumption has always been from the state that there would be a period where families would not have income and they'd search hard and they would, because they would have to put food on the table, they would find jobs and this would, in the end, be a good thing, sort of a tough love approach. The families that we were able to follow, their life situations did not change over the past 12 months. And you can look at that as either positive or negative, depending on how you're looking at it. But the families we spoke to, none of them who did not have jobs, none of them who were unemployed had jobs at the end of 12 months. None of them who had jobs at the beginning of 12 months were working at better jobs at the end of 12 months. Their living situations, a few more people that we spoke to were in worse living situations. Most of the living situations actually had not changed. So from a state's point of view, you can look at that as positively and say, look, the state is saving all this money and families aren't in any worse shape than they were. But from a social services point of view, you can say, wait a minute, the whole concept of this was that by removing these this cash assistance, people were going to get into the workforce, and we have not found evidence that that is happening.
You know, I know there's a fair segment of this of the population who just get so riled up about the idea that my hard-earned tax dollars are going to take going to somebody who's just irresponsible and lazy and living off the public dole. And there are cases of that. We all know that. We've all seen it for ourselves or heard the anecdotal stories. The point that I think everybody misses is, yeah, there might be a single mom who's been irresponsible or a family that's been irresponsible, but the kids are paying the price for this as well. There are more kids benefiting from this cash assistance than there are the household leaders, the household caretaker. The kids don't have the choices to make about whether to be responsible or whether not to be responsible. They just know they're hungry.
And
Lester brings up a very important point there. Only families get cash assistance, as generically been called welfare. If I am a single adult, I'm not getting this anyway. So this assistance is really for the benefit of the children. And so, as Lester said, a lot of times it's the children who are struggling because of this.
I would love to get both of you to comment on the statement that State Rep Ken Horn, who had tried to push this through for 4 years and it passed on his fifth try. Ron, you asked him, what will we learn about welfare reform? And here was his answer, quote, people will find their way in life. They'll pick up a hammer or a paintbrush and man up and feed their family. What did you think, Ron, about that answer then and now?
Well, at the time, I felt it was a very accurate representation of what a lot of people think in Michigan, and certainly in a lot of the legislature, that and you saw this in national politics too, where you have the debate over the makers versus the takers. That sense, and I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I'm saying a lot of people feel that way. That if you actually stop giving people money, then they'll go to work like the rest of us. Well, what Representative Horn did not take into account is that I believe over half of the recipients of cash assistance are either working or in a work training program already. It's just that oftentimes they earn so little money from those jobs, many of them are part-time jobs with no benefits, that they still qualify for cash assistance. And you have to take into account that a lot of these families, if you have been receiving cash assistance for either 4 years or 6 years, depending if you're looking at the federal or state limits, you probably face some work challenges in some way. Either your education is very low, some of these workers have physical limitations, some of them are caring for family members who are physically disabled in a way that they have to have someone home all the time. These are families who have some struggles anyway in finding a job. And the state has a worker training program. A lot of people have gone through it. In fact, it's a requirement for almost everyone who gets cash assistance to go through a worker training program. What I would like to see is more people say, well, you know, these people need to man up and grab a hammer. Well, most of them have been in this worker training program. Perhaps we should look more closely at that worker training program if these people have been through it and still are underemployed or unemployed.
The other thing you have to remember is, you know, our unemployment rate, while, you know, decreasing, is still really high. How many people with college degrees do you know who can't find a job or who have a skill set and have a work history and can't find a job? These are going to be the last people any employer is going to give a job because they don't have a history of working sometimes. They don't have the skill set that an experienced worker would. The other thing you have to consider is many of these people are single moms. They've got 2-4 kids. I talked to one person, 23 years old. She had 7 kids. How is she going to get a job, a minimum wage job, and support 7 kids? I mean, it's ludicrous on the face of it. I don't know what the answer is. I don't have a good answer. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the $16 million or $17 million the state is saving in doing this, I think there's going to be a greater cost in the long run because some of these kids are going to end up in foster care. Some of these kids are going to end up in jail. Some of these kids are never going to get the education that they need because they never had a stable home life because they have been moving from house to house. There's a long-term cost to this that this $17 million we might be saving right now, and that savings will increase, but that money we're saving is going to cost us long-term.
If you're just joining us here on Stateside, we're talking with Lester Graham, who is our investigative reporter, Michigan Watch reporter for Michigan Radio News, and Ron French, a writer for Bridge Magazine, talking about the loss of welfare cash assistance to many families in Michigan. Both of you commented on what you're seeing in the terms of tolls, human tolls taken on the families. Talk to us about some of the people that have their stories that have really personally struck you. Lester?
Well, I the one woman I talked to that really sticks out in my mind because she had her 5-year-old with her, and he kept interrupting the interview saying, Mom, I'm hungry. And, you know, that really got to me. But another person I talked to had a disabled child. You know, she could get welfare cash assistance if she, you know, took care of a disabled child. She was not able to take JET, which is the job training program. So now funding has ended for her. Cash assistance has ended for her. She has no job training. She's had no opportunity to get job training because she had to take care of this disabled kid. It's quite a catch-22, and nobody really expected that the exemptions for taking care of disabled kids would be eliminated as they have been in some cases. Is that right, Ron?
Yes, absolutely. There are about 600 families around the state who had been exempted from worker training because the only able-bodied potential worker in the family had needed to stay at home to care for a disabled child or spouse. These are families who are really stuck. Another woman I spoke to in Detroit who illustrates some of the unintended consequences of reform, this woman was receiving cash assistance and was actually in college, was attempting to get a nursing degree. And when her cash assistance was cut off, she had to drop out of school and find a job. I think she ended up working for a while in a soup factory, and she was then laid off. So situation where basically reform that was supposed to help you man up and find a job took a person from a college setting where they could have actually helped their family eventually and put them back into a situation where they will probably be earning minimum wage all their lives.
I know Governor Snyder noted there are families that have been getting cash assistance for as many as 14 years. And I'd like to get both of your thoughts on, is there merit in reining in how long people can get welfare benefits? How much of that should Michigan taxpayers have to support?
I think you can make a good argument that there needs to be a limit of some kind, that there needs to be some effort made to get people off of welfare. Some of these families that Governor Snyder is mentioning are families who have disabled members at home. If you live in areas of high unemployment, such as Detroit or Flint, the possibility of you staying on cash assistance is higher under the old rules. And so, you know, if you couldn't find a job, where in Detroit, you know, the unemployment rate is much, much higher than the state average.
Correct.
And it makes sense. You could stay on cash assistance for a longer period of time. Is it appropriate for someone to stay on welfare all their lives? No, but we also have families who are on Medicaid all their lives, who are on Social Security all their life because of disabilities. We live in a society where we try to take care of the neediest. And so some of these families, you're always going to have to assist as long as we're not sticking them out in the snow and letting them die.
One of the things the Solicitor General, who is basically the legal counsel for the state and for the DHS in this case, said after the Supreme Court arguments last week is that, you know, hey, this program is called the Temporary Assistance to Needy Families, TANF. It is temporary. It's never was intended to be permanent. And he said the DHS theory is that we should get these people back to work, or if they cannot work, they should get on a more permanent source of aid. Well, other than if you're disabled and you can get SSI through the Social Security Administration, I don't know what kind of permanent aid you can get. It's really limiting. And anybody who has had the need to apply for SSI knows that that's at least a two-year process. I don't know what you're going to do with your kids and your family in the meantime. It's a big gap.
I know.
Cynthia, we should point out that to be fair, Michigan is not out of line with all the other states with what their guidelines are today.
Some states are even shorter. I mean, they have a 36-month limit.
Absolutely. So we're on the short end of it, but we are not out of line with what some states are doing. And following up with something Lester said about the amount of money we're saving, I want to make it clear to everyone that the amount that the state is saving, it's between $16 and $18 million a month. So it's a fair amount of savings, but in the state budget, it's a pretty small amount, depending how you look at it. It's just a question of whether the money that you're saving there, the state is going to have to spend in other resources because of things that are happening to these families because they're not getting cash assistance.
As you pointed out, Lester. So I know it's a complicated morass here. Where do we go now?
Well, we're waiting on the Supreme Court right now. They're going to decide this whole question of 48 months versus 60 months. But the real question, I think, is, you know, everybody agrees that there's a problem with welfare, and cash assistance seems to be something that the legislature really believes has been abused. Well, where should the reforms really happen? Just cutting off the families isn't really going to solve a problem because a lot of those people are not going to be able to man up and pick up a hammer or a paintbrush. It's just not going to be – it's going to be beyond their resources, you know, their skills to do something like that. So what do we do? What kind of – why hasn't the job training programs worked better than they have? Is there a problem there? I think there are a lot of questions we need to ask, but I think there are a lot of questions we should have been asking before we decided to say 11,000 families are off. Now, I want to clarify, the 11,000 families are not off right now because of an injunction, but after the Supreme Court rules, that could very well be, and now I think it's up to about 13,000 families, right, Ron?
We're closer to 15,000, and of the 15,000 who were cut off between now, last fall and this fall, about between 6,000 and 7,000 of those are back on pending the court decision. Not everyone was placed back on. Some some families applied and their incomes were higher now, and so they couldn't go back on. So about half the families who were kicked off are actually getting a check at this moment, waiting on the court decision.
Ron Lester, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Lester Graham is the Michigan Watch investigative reporter for Michigan Radio News, and Ron French writes for Bridge Magazine. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. Our contributors are Allie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening. We'll talk again tomorrow at 3:00.